Jeff and Eric noticed one day that nobody on the internet talked about movies, so they had to find a way. They'll podcast thoughts on new movies they've discovered through autumn, winter, spring, and summer on Fridays. And when you run out of films you love to view, tune into jokes, playing games, all this and more you'll find contained on PBS with Bear and Snyder.
Hello and welcome to Movie BS with Bear and Snyder. I'm your host, Jeff Bear. This is co-host Eric D. Snyder.
Hello, I'm Eric D. Snyder. That's my co-host, Jeff Bear. Welcome to episode 300 of Movie BS with Bear and Snyder. Whoop, 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 whoop. That's the 300 alarm.
Oh, here we go. Wait, that's it?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
That's a pretty nice celebration for 300 episodes.
We have
episodes.
A very, very special show today. We're going to review a couple of movies and talk about Question of the Week. Really, we went all out for the special events.
Yep. Yeah. Well, we are in tuxes, which in hindsight, that was stupid.
There's no reason for it because nobody can see us.
Yeah. And I bought mine. Like, at least you rented yours.
For a second, I thought you said we were in Texas, which made even less sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that would make less sense. Although, goodness.
We will be right soon.
It's so soon.
But we're not there yet.
No, but good. Next week, we'll do the hint of a preview of South by Southwest.
Yeah, I guess. Probably. Yeah. Sounds like something we'd do.
That's normally, I've heard we do that sort of thing before. Yeah. Why wouldn't we do it now?
I don't know. All right, we got some movies to review. We're going to start with Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
What are three things I'm not good at?
Two out of three for me, Ben.
Wait, which two of those can you do? I know you can drink whiskey. Can you tango or foxtrot?
I could foxtrot. I can't tango, but I mean, give me an hour. I'll knock that out.
I'm sure I could learn to do either of those things. Just currently, I don't.
Yeah, you could. I don't think you could learn whiskey. I think it's just not for you.
That may be true. This has nothing to do with any of those things.
That's sad. But you know, it ends up getting better, so it's
someday,
okay.
Someday someone will make a movie about whiskey and dancing.
Mm-hmm.
This though is based on a memoir by one Kim Barker. She's called Kim Baker in the movie.
They totally see the curveball there?
Mm-hmm. And she was a reporter in Afghanistan. And Tina Fey is her now. Tina Fey plays Kim Baker.
Are you reading this off the teleprompter? What's going on?
Whoops. Knocking my microphone
apart.
Over.
It's falling apart. Yeah, we got Tina Fey here. And guess what, everybody? It starts with a flash forward. And I'm not upset about this flash forward.
Huh.
It has a purpose behind it.
Oh.
The
Go
purpose.
On. Explain.
I think this is exactly the purpose. And if the movie did this accidentally, bravo for them for getting this accident right. So the movie is not about a bumbling reporter finally figuring things out. This is about a journey.
Right, right. She's never been in the out in the war zone before, but she's good at what she does. She's a good reporter.
And because we know Tina Fey really well, but we don't know this Kim Baker character, they need to prove to us this is not about a silly oops, where are my high heels reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And if we started chronologically, it would show how green she was. And we would be wondering, oh, is she going to make it as a journalist? Which isn't the point.
Because she gets to Afghanistan in 2003 and has to kind of get her bearings and everything.
Right. And so this flash forward serves to
in 2006
show you, hey, don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
She's good. She's no nonsense. Like she might start off a little green, but that's not the point here. So don't worry about that.
Right.
And that's why I really liked this flash forward. It was purposeful. And jump arounds cranking in the beginning of the movie, which is like, whoa, give me that energy. Thanks.
Don't you agree that all movies should start with jump around? Tell me one movie that wouldn't be better if it started with jump around.
Yeah, even Mary Poppins. Like, for sure. Everything would be better with jump around. Because you got to jump. You got to jump up to get
down. Jump up to get down. Right.
That's so true. Because otherwise, you're already there, so you can't get down without. Yeah, it's a really good point from that song.
Anyway, so that's Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. So she's a reporter for. They don't ever say it's not CNN. They just say the network. I gather. Yeah. She's over there. Gets sent over there to when Afghanistan starts because everyone else is busy with Iraq. In 2003. So they're sending like the B team over to Afghanistan to cover this new war. And she's got there's security detail and there's other reporters. She kind of becomes friends with Margot Robbie, who is a BBC reporter.
She's the only other
female reporter there.
Seasoned female war correspondent. She's known like Kim Baker sees her on a TV before she goes over there. And and Tanya seems like she's taking her under her wing for this friendship. Let's go, women! Rah rah rah!
And so Kim has got a boyfriend back home. We know he's not long for this world, though. Like that boyfriend's not sticking around.
He doesn't
blow
up or anything. But
no, but I just you know that boyfriend won't still be her boyfriend at the end of the movie.
That is definitely something you know. And we meet a cast of characters, some of which some of which do a really nice job. It's just that tinge of like you couldn't have found somebody else to play this role.
For example, the local Afghan man Fahim Ahmadzadze, who is a local fixer who helps her out, played by the great Middle Eastern actor Christopher Abbott from
Christopher
Girls.
Christopher Abbott does a really nice job with this role, but I cannot shake the fact that they picked the wrong human being to play this role.
Such a strange choice.
And then also
Ali Masood Sadiq, the new attorney general of Afghanistan, a smooth operator who kind of gets a crush on Kim.
That's even worse, by the way.
Played by the great Egyptian actor, Alfred Molina.
I'm so surprised that they went ahead and did this. In those two instances, they just flat out get casting wrong for me to because I'm constantly like, is that the guy from Girls? I think that's the guy. No, that's not the guy from. Yeah, no, that is the guy from Girls.
Alfred Molina
is just like, oh, come on. Now you're a caricature almost, my friend.
Alfred Molina, by the way, do you know what his ethnicity is, his racial background?
No clue.
Italian and Spanish. His mother was Italian. His father was Spanish. And he was born in London.
There we go.
Good for you, Alfred Molina. And then, of course, he became Dr. Octopus. They don't talk about that anymore. So those casting issues are weird, a little weird. But apart from that, you got Billy Bob Thornton as the general who's running things over there.
Can we stop right now? Hang on.
Yeah.
Is he the skinniest actor in Hollywood? It's getting out of hand.
He is looking very slender, though.
It's weird how skinny he's gotten.
I didn't think he looked unhealthy or anything.
He's on the verge of unhealthy. I think he's got an eating disorder. I'm calling it. It is weird how skinny this man is now.
Okay. No, it's not, but all right.
All right.
And who else?
Martin
Freeman. Martin Freeman is a Scottish photojournalist. Yep. An obnoxious guy.
And then we got just like tiny little side characters like Tull Bryan that add lovely flavor to the film. A guy who loves donkey porn.
Yeah, there's a local guy who likes donkey porn.
You know, stuff. And what you realize is you're just on this journey with Kim Baker. And Tina Fey is not showing a ton of range in this, but nor should she. This is the stoic, on occasion, Liz Lemon. This is the more controlled, quieter demeanor. But at the same point, it's not asking too much of Tina Fey. And frankly, there's been only one time where she's properly shown range. So it's really good that this is in her wheelhouse. And it does feel like perfect casting for a 40-something journalist who wants more out of life. And she wants to get that adrenaline rush of war correspondence.
I'm glad that she finally has a chance to do something more than Liz Lemon, because there is some of Liz Lemon there because it's Tina Fey, and Liz Lemon is Tina Fey. But here she's not a sitcom character.
Definitely
she plays
not. She's not
a fully realized, developed character. I see a real acting going on there.
Yes.
It's about her. We come to learn that she had felt kind of complacent at her desk job back at the network, being a news producer, news writer, and that now she comes to enjoy the adrenaline rush of being embedded with the troops, and then the struggle of getting airtime for stories about Afghanistan after a couple of years when the public loses interest in Afghanistan. As the head of the network says, as much as people love the troops, they don't actually want to watch them on the news.
Yeah.
Which, unfortunate but true. Or it was in 2006 anyway. Things are probably better now. I don't know. She encounters the fact that women in Afghanistan are fairly bad off. And I thought the movie was going to do more with, and I don't know if it should have or not, but it got a little bit into those women's issues and how Kim, being a woman, could maybe better appreciate certain aspects of it than her colleagues could. But then they didn't do a whole lot of that in the movie, but it's there.
I'm guessing with that, it's more just like, well, Kim Barker didn't, so Kim Baker won't.
Right. Yeah. Sure.
I don't know, because it is sprinkled in there. It's definitely not the focus of like a female reporter.
And then of course all the sexual politics too. They get into a lot about how with so few women over there that the other journalists and the soldiers. I'm sorry, not soldiers, Marines. They get mad when you call a Marine a soldier. Because it's two totally different things. It's not just an arbitrary rivalry, like when colleges decide their football teams don't like each other. It is totally not that. Anyway, but then all the men sort of go crazy for what few women are there and how women can use that power to get what they need. And I like all those dynamics.
I do too.
Very complicated.
Is it the best film that Tina Fey has been in?
Best film that she's been in?
Yeah.
Like in any role, even a small role?
Probably not, because Mean Girls, most people would probably say.
Mean Girls, I think, is probably a better movie.
Yeah. As far as the lead role.
As far as the lead, for sure.
I think it's definitely the case.
Yeah, no question there as the lead. She hasn't played the lead
in
very many.
I really liked the relationship of just the dynamic with the journalists and how they chased the high and what it meant to them and who was willing to go the extra mile and what that really meant. It didn't get into definitive this is right, this is wrong area. It is a nice gray area to live in when you're over there, it seemed. As far as like what decisions you'll make. And then, there's violence.
There is some violence.
And that's the thing that the movie made you forget for a while that this was a war.
Right.
But that was in a good way, because then when the violence was brought in, it did serve as an awakening, but also almost like a discomfort with how some characters responded in those adrenaline rushed situations. Where it's just like, oh my gosh, you're almost a machine. Like,
right.
Look around you. Look what's actually happening. So I loved that atmosphere of it. Because, we have plenty of war movies to where it's like, always find fringe characters, like war correspondents or somebody else to pay attention to beyond just the soldiers, because we have so many examples of that.
Right. You mean Marines, not soldiers.
Right. Sorry.
The movie starts out fairly funny, and it's got a lot of funny stuff in it, but it ultimately is not. I don't think it's a comedy. It's more of a dramedy, a drama with a comedy in it.
Agreed.
Especially as you say, when the violence, there's some shocking instances of violence that do kind of wake us up and remind us that this is serious business. And I think the movie does a pretty good job of balancing it without making it too funny or too intense or serious, without It doesn't demean the seriousness of the war by turning it all into a joke, but it's not like all totally serious and bogged down either.
Right.
I think it's a good balance. Glenn Ficarra and John Requa are the directors, and they're the guys who made I Love You, Philip Morris, and Crazy Stupid Love.
That's good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah, those are movies.
Yeah.
Those are pretty good movies.
I like those movies. Yeah.
Oh, they also made Focus, that thing last year with Will Smith. Oh, and Margot Robbie.
Yeah.
I forgot that was them.
I did too.
Yeah. Anyway, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. By the way, that title is never mentioned or referenced in the movie, nor does it appear on screen, not at the beginning or the end.
Oh, weird.
I was watching the beginning. We go right into it without the title. And I thought at the end it would say the title there. No, just right into the credits. So I don't even – there's no proof that that is the title of this movie.
Thank you. Good job.
We're using strictly outside sources here.
Yeah. You were sleuthing there. That's what you were doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also written by Robert Carlock, adapted from that memoir. Robert Carlock was a 30 Rock writer, and he played what was his name on 30 Rock? Never mind. I lied. I was getting him mixed up with somebody who was on 30 Rock. But no, anyway, he was a 30 Rock writer.
And didn't you say you saw Lorne Michaels in the credits?
Lorne Michaels, the producer. Yeah.
Oh.
So it's not as wacky as you might think, given those credentials, but somewhat wackier than you might expect for a war movie. Anyway, I give it a nice solid B.
I give it a nice solid 7 out of 10.
There you go.
I honestly, you change two casting decisions and it's an 8 for me.
Well, it's a little late for should-haves.
I know. It's a good point.
Next up, London Has Fallen.
Pum, pum, pum.
This is a sequel to Olympus Has Fallen.
Right. The surprising sequel, I would say.
Right. Because they remember a few years ago there were the two movies about the White House being attacked.
This one and the one that we knew was coming, which was
White House Down.
White House Down with Jamie Foxx and Channing Tatum.
Right.
And if one was going to be the assumed box office hit, it would have been that one.
That one was PG-13. It had C. Tates and Jamie Foxx.
C. Tates?
Sure.
All right.
But then somehow Olympus Has Fallen, which was rated R and had Gerard Butler and Aaron Eckhart, somehow that's the one that gets a sequel.
And Morgan Freeman, right? He was in it.
He was the vice president, I guess. Yeah,
he was in it.
So anyway, that's a sequel. And so now, they couldn't have the White House get attacked again. That would be ridiculous.
That would be ridiculous. They had to do something much more logical.
So instead, the British Prime Minister has died, so there's a big funeral. Mm-hmm. So heads of state from 40 countries, 40 different security teams.
Oh, it, and no time to plan.
No, it's going to be a cluster cuss. And sure enough, while it's there, President Aaron Eckhart and Secret Service Agent Gerard Butler are there in town, and sure enough, big ol' attack.
Well, because you see, two years before this, there was a drone strike, tried to kill an arms dealer terrorist, but instead killed his daughter,
his sister at a wedding.
No, his daughter, the old guy with the cane. But then the other guy's sister.
It's a whole
family thing, really. Well, yeah, terrorists are very close knit.
Well, and here's the thing. That's a fair point to be mad about that. About you,
I 100% agree.
Even if I'm a terrorist, I'm a bad guy. Okay, still, fine. Kill me when you accidentally leave me alive, but kill my family. So that's not cool.
Not only that, it's obvious it was a big old party.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And they're like, you got authorization. Go ahead.
Well, I go for it. Yeah. He's there, and then they kill everybody except him. Yeah. Anyway, so he's peeved about that.
Right. And then Gerard Butler's got a lot on his plate this time because his wife's pregnant, so he's got to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
I'm glad he was thinking about it because I forgot it.
Yeah. So did the movie.
Yeah.
There's just very much like the first one. It was funny because I didn't really recall the first one that much.
Yeah.
And watching this one, it kept dawning on me what the first one did. The first one did a lot of unnecessary, deep,
gratuitous
dark
violence, yeah.
Death.
Mm-hmm. I remember that about the first one.
Like, look how serious this is.
Lots of headshots in the first one.
And in this case, it's once again, there's nothing interesting, no action to speak of for quite a while until all hell breaks loose. Right. And it's just very procedural, very serious. This could really happen. Mm-hmm. The thing that can't really happen is half of London can't be in on it.
Like,
that's the
It's a very big coordinated attack where, yeah, they've got dozens of assassins who are undercover.
Hundreds.
Who are undercover and each have a specific target.
Right. And the guy who's, like, a regular London cop has not recognized that half of his squad is now clearly looking a little bit different.
I think that whenever there's a sequel like this where something big happened in the first one and then in the second movie something like it happens again, like with Die Hard where it happens again, I think that somewhere some of the movie should have to go, here we go again.
Well, it's like okay, so you know how Olympus, I guess there is some, like, I was actually surprised how many critics on Twitter were like, oh man, I'm getting to see London Is Falling tonight.
Well, I didn't dislike Olympus Is Falling.
I didn't mind.
It was gratuitously violent. But I wasn't like looking forward to
it. It feels like Olympus Has Fallen was like, I don't know, maybe like a C+. I don't exactly, I think I gave it a 6. I don't remember.
Something like that,
but
probably.
But it feels like the movie has decided, oh, we got a mandate. Like, we were an overwhelming success, so now in our second term, we have the right to do all of this and more. And
it's, I guess, just, if you're going to do it, might as well go big, I suppose.
Yeah. So anyway, lights go out in London, and now President and...
lots of people get killed. Lots of foreign leaders and civilians and terrorists. Hundreds of people are killed. Don't worry, though. The Americans survive.
And don't worry. Gerard Butler has a knife, and he's going to push it into so many heads.
Heads
so
and torsos
many heads.
And legs and so
was that
many...
something that happened in the first one?
What I remember for the first one is lots of gunshots to the head. Lots of headshots.
This time it's like, nah, let's forget the bullets and let's stick knives in faces.
Yeah.
And so they do.
A lot of that. The CGI is so-so. But yeah. I did note that during the big attack sequences and the escaping and the chasing, all that was all exciting enough.
It's all
into that, sure.
Decent, good-looking enough action. There was one moment, there was three helicopters. Mm-hmm. Did you hear what they said? Marine 2, prepare for sacrifice.
Yeah.
That made me feel something. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it is just so...
vaguely distasteful.
So distasteful, and so, like, screw you, we're America.
Carelessly, graphically violent.
Yeah, it was really weird.
Reminded
that
me of Bad
way.
Boys 2. It's like, oh, this is, the guy who made this movie enjoys watching people die.
And Gerard Butler, his character does think he's in a Die Hard movie instead of the instead of the serious thing, because he will, at any point, I would say, maybe a third of the time he attempted some sort of joke, and the other two-thirds of the time he just said the F-bomb.
Right.
Like in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I'm a little worried that this is going to become the next Fast and the Furious, where there'll be like a fairly mediocre movie followed by a sequel, and there's going to be like 8 of them. That like a bunch of our critic colleague friends are going to either pretend to like or maybe actually like. I can't tell with some of them on Fast and the Furious.
I felt like it's not a very, is it a political movie? Because it felt like the core audience would be somebody that would decide America's the best and everything else is evil. Because at one point, there was the line, everybody is a terrorist until proven otherwise.
Right.
And there is a certain part of our population that could hear that line and be like, yeah, right, that's the way we should live everything.
And in the context, that was not an unreasonable thing to say, where they didn't know who had infiltrated the thing. But
agreed.
Yes, out of context.
But out
yes.
of context. And that's and the thing. I feel like this movie can be taken out of context because of its serious tone. If it somehow find that lighthearted president is being attempted to be executed on live interwebs,
right,
like the lighthearted version of that, like the PG-13 version of that, maybe then they'd be okay. But there's That's something what, about...
For the first one, too, it loses some of the fun of it with how sort of gross it is. And this one definitely is a tribute to American exceptionalism.
Yeah.
Even like they make a point of pointing out that one of the reasons that the American president survives is that the Secret Service agent unilaterally moved the schedule up 10 minutes. Totally screwed up the rest, like the British people, like everything, messed everything up, but it saved their lives because, hey, we do what we want.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
we know there's 40 world leaders here in their own security details, but we're Americans, we're doing our own thing, and here, sure enough, it saved their lives.
By the way, just in general, if a world leader dies, my hunch is an autopsy happens sooner.
Because yeah, that was yeah. that was part of the thing of like
it's a, yeah he died in his sleep yeah
this is suspicious
although yeah although even even if they'd figured out immediately that he'd been killed wouldn't necessarily mean oh so the funeral's all just a trap
I get you're right but yeah. Yeah and then there's weird things like Melissa Leo being back in this movie. I think she might have had one line. Otherwise, she just looks terrified in
the situation room.
In the situation
her
room.
Her and there's poor Robert Forster there. Never gets to leave the room.
Jackie Earl Haley. What is his
Jackie
name?
Jackie Earl Haley, yeah. Yeah,
he's in there and just again.
Trapped in the situation room.
Just hanging out in the situation room. Maybe high-fiving, maybe being nervous. That's their whole role. And so it's they get the gang back together, but it's not for that furious fun vibe.
No, it's not.
And it's not silly, and that's the weird part of this. Like,
it's not serious, but it's not as serious as it thinks it is.
No.
But it's not as funny as it thinks it is either.
No, like, I keep wanting to laugh at how serious it's taking itself, right. Or how serious it thinks it is. And then there's just weird leaps. At one point, they're like, we believe the president to be in this room. And it's not, right. Why?
Who, yeah, what do you base that
why, on? You, everything is a rush job here. You have no time for research of any kind. But when the action's happening, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's probably, it's in like a 95-minute movie. There's probably like 25 minutes that I was like really into.
Yes.
That sounds about
I'm
right,
I'm going to completely sign off on that.
All right, so I give it a C.
I'm a 4 out of 10 because there's something very distasteful about this. You give me my gratuitous violence in a different way, please.
Yeah, just not as bloody, not as gratuitous.
Actually, no. I can handle it. I just want a different atmosphere around it.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
Then we got a cartoon that you missed, but I saw it, so I'll tell you all about it.
Please do.
Called Zootopia.
It sounds magical.
Disney cartoon, not Pixar, Disney. And this is set in a world where...
In a world.
It's all animals. There's no people. There's no reference to people. And there's also no... It's only mammals. There's no reptiles or birds or insects ever even mentioned.
They're
not even referenced. In this world, the mammals, thousands of years ago, evolved to where predators and prey now live in peaceful coexistence. They all get along. Oh. There's no praying. Yeah.
It's just a really happy world.
Yeah, just no trouble. No trouble.
Oh.
They don't ever say what predators eat instead of other animals. You just kind of go with it, I guess. Just trust.
Do you see food at any point?
I'm trying to remember now if – well, yeah, no, I know there we see like rabbits eating carrots and stuff. I can't remember if we ever see any predators eating anything. Oh, yeah, we do because there's some predator – no, let's see. Yeah, there's some predators eating some ice cream. Anyway, not the point. The point is they all live together, and the movie is about racism.
What?
It's about race relations.
Really?
Oh, I know. I'd be rolling my eyes, too. Because you tell me, oh, it's a Disney cartoon about race relations. You're like, oh, brother, here we go. It's never preachy, even for a minute. And here's how they pull it off. Because it sets up situations that sort of mimic real life issues without being direct parallels to them. I'll tell you what I mean.
Please do.
We got this bunny, Judy Hopps. And in an early scene, as a child, she is threatened by a fox who's got this redneck Southern accent.
Okay.
And he's like, you're a dumb bunny. You're always going to live in the bunny. He doesn't say ghetto, but in the bunny world, I'm going to keep you down. And so it's like, oh, okay. So in this analogy, bunnies are black people and foxes are white bigots. That's what you think. But no, later on, it's basically reversed. We come to see that foxes are the ones that are kind of oppressed and mistrusted. And the bunnies tend to be the white bigots. And then in other cases, it's broader. It's not foxes and bunnies, but predators and prey, or large animals versus small animals. And so basically, every animal has its moments of being prejudiced or being accepting or being right or being wrong without ever nailing it down to, okay, this animal represents this race, et cetera. And so it gives it this there's no hashtag Fox Lives Matter or anything like that.
Right.
They don't get that specific. which is good. By keeping it that sort of jumbled up, it means, first of all, they avoid the controversy of there being a Disney cartoon about Black Lives Matter or whatever. And instead, the message is one that no reasonable person can disagree with, which is that we can acknowledge the differences between our species without being unequal, and that even though we sometimes have feelings of bigotry and fear, and those can come from honest emotional places, because that bunny did have a bad experience with a fox.
Right.
Like she did, you know, you don't blame her for being wary of foxes after that.
Yeah.
But that we must overcome those impulses and judge one another as individuals, not as groups. And again, no one can disagree with that except racists. And I don't care what they think.
Really nice job of explaining.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, I'm thinking of becoming a film critic.
Huh.
And it's also really funny. I mean, more to the point, it's very funny. And so I like how they some amusing examples. There's a lamb with the woolly hair, and the fox and the bunny are like keep trying to touch the woolly hair to see what it feels like.
Yes.
But again, sheep don't represent black people in this movie. Just for that one moment, they do. The bunny gets a little offended. She says, "I know you hear other bunnies call each other cute, but it's kind of offensive when non-bunnies call us that." And the fox cringes when someone refers to him as articulate. So there's lots of things like that sprinkled throughout. And I like that it's evenly distributed, kind of suggesting that, yeah, we all have our moments of getting it wrong.
Please tell me Shakira is just amazing in this film.
Shakira plays a pop star named Gazelle. She's a gazelle. She's not a significant character, but she's in there.
Yeah.
The plot, we've got a bunny, Judy Hopps, voice of Jennifer Goodwin, who becomes
Jennifer.
She's actually the first bunny cop. There's not been a bunny who's been a cop before. Which, in a twist, I came to realize that wasn't like a racial thing. It's a size thing. All the other cops are just bigger animals, is what I realized. But that's a whole other dimension too that makes it interesting.
you love this.
I'm really into this world because there's a scene because like rabbits are prey animals. They are not predators. But there's a scene where Judy Hopps wreaks havoc on a mouse neighborhood just because she's so much bigger.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes even the prey, the oppressed, sometimes can be the oppressors, et cetera. And then there's a fox, not the fox who threatened her when she was a kid, but another fox, voice of Jason Bateman, who's really got a Bill Murray thing going. I never noticed before with his voice and his delivery. Jason Bateman's got like a good, like dry, sardonic Bill Murray kind of delivery that works well for him.
Definitely never thought of that before.
And he plays Nick Wilde, this fox.
Besides those two, like, is there anybody else that's kind of a lead character? Like, tons of voices here. I don't want to necessarily go through them all.
Those are the two main ones. It's about she's a cop, and then he's a street, you know, like a con artist, and they wind up having to work together to solve a mystery. She, of course, new on the force, is assigned as a meter maid, but she stumbles onto this case where a bunch of predators have gone missing. Missing persons or missing mammals. Reports of various predators going missing, and so they investigate that. And so it's basically a buddy cop comedy that happens to involve animals, and that is all an allegory about race relations. I'm sure it'll be funny for kids, but it's definitely aimed like more at grown-ups, I think.
I'm gonna throw this out there. Mm-hmm. If you look at the character names, I'm just gonna guess that Duke Weaselton might end up being the bad guy in the movie. It's just a hunch.
Not the main bad guy. He's just a weasel. A weasel really is going to be more of like a henchman, like a weaselly. Yeah, he helps the.
Based on names alone, that would be the one.
Idris Elba is Chief Bogo. That's Chief of Police, and he's like a water buffalo or something.
Nice. Does Tommy Chung play somebody who appears to be high?
He plays a yak. Who he's doing the full-on classic, "All right, man," Tommy Chong voice, who is a yak at an animal nudist colony, which to me was one of the funniest things that I've seen in a while, this scene of animal – because the animals all wear clothes because it's that kind of world, except this scene where there's a bunch of nude animals being nude.
That is pretty funny.
Quite funny.
Yeah.
I really, really clever jokes and a really clever way of – getting into these issues in a way that's not preachy or sanctimonious or really doesn't seem like it's presenting a message, again, other than that obvious let's all be nice to each other message. Yeah. So if it's propaganda, if it's indoctrination, it's the kind of thing that anyone would be glad to have their kids see, because it's a very positive message.
Racist parents, do not take your kids to this movie.
True. Racist, and I think you know who you are. I hope you do. Anyway, yeah, it's a very enjoyable, entertaining, funny, clever cartoon. I give it a B+.
B+. Lovely.
And now, question of the week.
Question of the week.
When we asked for examples of a seemingly small or dumb thing that completely ruined a movie for you. Many fine nitpicking examples that I can get behind here.
Yeah, we wanted the nit and the pick.
Emily points out blatant product placements. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. She gives an example, the dating website in that Walter Mitty movie, or any search bar in any movie. I tend to agree. The product placement is always tricky, because if it's obviously not a real product, that always looks fake.
Right.
It's like, don't have them drink cola. Have them drink a Coke or a Pepsi or whatever.
Especially cola with the exact font of Coca-Cola. Right. Like, it's just like, come on.
Just make a Coke. That's fine. Yeah. We forgive you. But then if it's too blatant, right, too obviously holding the label toward the camera, that's annoying.
Steph actually said the crappy comedy parts of Kristen Wiig and Donald Glover in The Martian ruined the film for him.
Fair enough.
Donald Glover was on the verge of bugging me in The Martian. I can understand it.
Yeah.
I'm a Glover fan, but that was almost like, all right, settle down doing your nerd impression.
And I'm a Kristen Wiig fan, but she did, in that movie, she seemed out of place to me.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just because I don't associate her with that kind of thing.
But then again, I mean, that's why it was the best comedy of last year.
That's true. Thanks to those comedy performances.
Yeah.
Colin, here's a good one. He says, in the live-action 101 Dalmatians, supposedly set in the UK, where Colin lives, there are skunks and raccoons included in the local fauna. These are not native animals. I didn't realize that. But yes, there are not skunks and raccoons in England. So why would they be in that movie? Good point. And then he has another one. This I didn't know. He says, this is a problem with many film and TV shows. Most irritating example was in Spy. Rose Byrne's character should be referred to as Boyanova, not Boyanov. Female Slavic names should always have an A at the end, and they so rarely do in American media. I didn't know that, but I believe you, Colin.
Porter says it didn't ruin the movie for him, but Bill Murray's line, gee, you're such an upbeat lady, in Groundhog Day, always sticks out as being so out of place in the middle of a great movie.
What's out of place about it? I don't understand.
He thinks the freezing of the moment with that line, and his reaction, he's got a weird face when he says that line. Mm. I remember that part. So yeah, maybe it just, it feels like it's pausing the film unnecessarily or abruptly, halting the flow perhaps. Mm. But again, I'm not Porter. All so right. I don't know Fair specifically. Enough. I'm just trying to channel the Porter that I have a hunch is brewing on that Facebook.
Porter, explain yourself. Sam, who once knitted us some winter caps.
Oh, Sam.
Thanks, Sam. She says, it drove me irrationally nuts in Hateful Eight when Michael Madsen took the care of selecting and paying for peppermint sticks, put one in his mouth, then immediately threw it away into the snow. I was a lot more annoyed by the waste of a good peppermint stick than by all of the assorted blood and violets. I don't remember noticing, but I do. It does bother me in movies when people order food or drinks and then don't eat or drink them. And it happens all the time. Yeah. They go to a bar, get a drink. They don't pay for it. They don't drink it. And they leave. I'm like, well, what about that drink? What are you doing?
Ryan says, Happy Gilmore. Supposed golf pros insist over and over that you must play it as it lies, even when the ball has clearly landed on people or man-made obstacles. The golfing in Happy Gilmore really did bug me to the point where I couldn't happily fall in love with that film. Even though it was at the time, I was just like, "Give me another! Oh my God, Adam Sandler's doing golf. This is going to be the
best." Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah,
I remember. Even I noticed that. I was like, "That's not how that works. That's not the rule."
Yeah.
the Dallas says in The Amazing Spider-Man, Peter Parker uses Bing. No one does that. It's completely unbelievable. Fair. Scott mentions in Aloha, where Emma Stone was doing the world's worst impersonation of a Hawaiian. Did you see Aloha? I didn't.
Yes, okay. I did.
I don't know if that would have bothered me or not, but yeah.
That was pretty rough. Kevin makes a good point. Fictional characters in movie biopics. Every time I find out that it's like, oh yeah, that person wasn't real, it was like, well, come on. It's not impossible to make the real story interesting by using facts.
Some stories it would be. Some stories just aren't interesting. But I agree.
Yeah.
If you're going to tell this true story, why not tell the true story? Kevin mentions Eddie the Eagle being the latest example, referring, I assume, to the Hugh Jackman character.
Right.
He's fictional.
By the way, Zach says, 5 minutes into The Village, my mom mentioned that she could see part of the mic. She then reminded me the mic was there every 5 minutes for the rest of the movie.
Let me pause you there. Shut up, Mom. I'm trying to watch the movie.
Is what should have happened.
Right.
The mic ruined The Village for my mom. My mom's repeated pointing out of the mic and wondering if it was part of the twist ruined The Village for me. The Village ruined The Village for everyone else. Actually, some people, including you, I think I kind of liked The Village.
I liked it until the end, which I felt was a cheat.
Right. Lady in the Water, another M. Night Shyamalan, was threw me a curveball because of how much the mic was in the shot. A comical margin that I had never seen before.
Yeah.
And it did make me think, oh, wait, is this part of the twist?
Right.
Is it a world within a world?
It's interesting that that's
because of how bad it was.
Interesting that that's two Shyamalan films, because the thing with seeing a boom mic in the shot is that it's almost always a projection issue.
Right.
Because the way that they shoot a movie, they film more real estate than will actually be on the screen. And so if you see the mic, it's because the projectionist didn't frame it right. But with The Village, there were multiple reports of this happening lots of places. So I think it must have been a Shyamalan thing where even by the usual standards of how you do that, he let the mic get too close to the action.
He might not be as good of a filmmaker as he thinks he is.
That would be a shocking twist.
Yeah. Some people try to say something about Quentin Tarantino, but it doesn't make sense, so I don't even know if I should read these answers.
Edward says, Meek's cut off. A bunch of settlers are traveling about in newly sewn clothing with a little bit of chocolate cake mix on their cheeks. I would expand that to lots of movies where characters ought to be filthy and wretched, and they're not as filthy and wretched as they ought to be. Like any movie set in the Middle Ages, people should have just like the worst teeth, and they should smell of feces all the time.
The theater should pipe in fecal material, fresh fecal material, to really give you that standard. Do you have an answer here?
I do have one. Do you have one?
I have one.
Okay. Mine, and this didn't – it's from The Goonies, and this is not what ruined The Goonies, because The Goonies is just hard to watch anyway as an adult, because it's 12-year-old boys screaming at each other.
Yes.
But one particular thing that annoys me in that movie and always has is they're in the cave or whatever, the thing with the booby traps, and there's like a pipe organ or something, and they got to play the notes. And there's some confusion. They're not sure whether the note that they're supposed to play is supposed to be A sharp or B flat, which are the same note. There's the same different words for the same note, written differently on the music, but on the actual keyboard of the organ, it's the same key. It doesn't matter what you call it, and that's dumb.
I could see how that would, yes. It's a perfect showcase of something that would bother you.
Yeah. I can't tell if it's an A sharp or a B flat. That's because you're an idiot who can't read music, and those are the same things. Ugh, The Goonies. What's yours?
White men can't jump.
Oh, because they can?
No. Oh. No, they got that part right.
Okay.
Wesley Snipes is not good at basketball.
Okay.
And I had that inkling when I watched it, and I love Wesley Snipes in that movie, except when he's playing basketball. Mainly, like, he dribbles, like, him dribbling, you know, you're supposed to keep the ball low when you dribble. Sure. Makes it harder to steal. There's so many times where he's, like, dribbling at eye level.
You know what else? You can't dribble with both hands. That's double dribbling.
Good job. But then the more I learned of, like, the making of and blah, 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 it was like, Yeah, 100%. He can't play. Like, they tried to teach him basketball before the movie. And that is a movie that I think, even with Rosie Perez doing her voice, would hold up. But, like, it just, I can't watch it because of how annoying it is that every, like, he's the best basketball player in the movie, and he's not.
That's fair.
He's not even good. And so, here's this great idea.
Yeah.
Remake White Men Can't Jump.
All right. Who stars in it?
Oh, I don't know. People that can play basketball. Oh, yes, I do.
Where are you going to find a black actor who can play basketball?
Well, the ideal is somebody who's actually looking for some sort of basketball movie, which would be Michael B. Jordan.
Oh, yeah.
And then you make the white guy like a crafty older guy, maybe like a sarcastic, like a Ryan Reynolds. He's so hot right now, Ryan Reynolds. And there you go. There's your movie.
That kind of reminds me.
And still can't jump.
That kind of reminds me of Casablanca, which is one of my favorite movies. But one part of it that drives me crazy is that Sam, the piano player, any shot where we see him playing the piano, it looks as though the actor had perhaps never even seen a piano before. Like, he's not even pretending. He's just sort of like randomly flopping his hands near the keyboard.
Yeah.
It's like, at least try.
This is – so both of us – both of our answers are something that we feel like we're fairly good at, that we've noticed.
Something that we are experts on, or that we are familiar with. Yeah, and I think that – I would think that's probably would be a common cause of those kinds of complaints.
Right.
Or like that movie a few weeks ago, The Choice, where the main act – the main guy in it was supposed to be super hot, and everyone could – they could talk about how hot he is, and he gets whatever he wants because he's hot. But the actor playing him was like average, and I kept thinking, you know, we can see him, right?
The best part of that was like The Choice. What did I think of The Choice? How did I feel about? Oh yeah, I didn't see The Choice.
See, yeah.
It's like there was a movie called Choice. Oh yeah, think Jeff, think.
Yes, you made the right choice.
Yep.
Thank you all for your answers, one and all. Oh, you know what? I want to mention one more because somebody emailed us. It was a nice email from a listener Alina, longtime listener, first time emailer. She loves the show.
Aww.
And she says, I like Mission Impossible 5 a lot. I know both of you do, too. I didn't like the very detail where Rebecca Ferguson, like a lot of action movie female characters, doesn't have combat-efficient shoes during operations. And then Alina kind of goes on for a while about this. not like a rant, but like, and she's a good point. It's like in the franchise where the male lead has been using a 3D face printer for two decades, his female partner, who has to be changed every episode, by the way, can't even get a pair of appropriate shoes with removable heels. Those have been on the market for so long and should be standard equipment for all female agents who have a fancy pants event to attend.
Yeah.
It's a good point. That's a very valid point.
And not only that, it would be a creative moment for the film.
Yeah.
Like, it's a missed opportunity.
Like, oh, I'm prepared for that. Pull off the heels and now I can run. Yeah.
Or what else can the heel do? Where can it go? Can it be a different kind of an accessory? Can it be a weapon? Blah, 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 blah. Come on, people.
Yeah, it's true. And Alina acknowledges that Hollywood is slowly switching to themes where female characters are actually doing something instead of just being pretty. Yeah. And Mission Impossible 5 is the one where Tom Cruise has the least romantic interaction with his female partner. These are all good things. We can see they're trying to build a really strong, independent, still attractive, but also skillful female agent. Then give that woman some appropriate shoes to fight in.
Thank you.
Good point, Alina, and thanks for writing. Question of the week for next week. Suggested to us. I'm sorry, I've been drinking. Suggested to us by listener Patrick. He asks, what movie embarrasses you because of the way it portrays a part of your identity? For example, your hometown, subculture, interests, etc.
Well, I mean, I don't think any film's ever mentioned Iowa before in any sort of way. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think that's an interesting thought-provoking question.
Yeah.
What movie embarrasses you because of the way it portrays some part of your identity? You can email us your answers, as Alina did, at moviebspdx@gmail.com, and it'll be on Facebook, as these things tend to be. Let's play a game. Let's play a round of Interquel.
Interquel.
Interquel works in this fashion. We will each name a movie. We have not pre-discussed this. And then we'll pretend those are parts one and three in a trilogy and make up what the middle movie would be to connect them. What's your movie, Jeff Baer?
The Princess Bride.
A fine film.
Thank you.
Mine is Fantastic Mr. Fox.
We just saw Fantastic Mr. Fox.
That's why it's my movie.
Interesting. Oh, because then you'll actually remember
it. It's actually fresh in my memory. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, good. That's good. Those are both fantasy stories, so it should be fairly easy to tie them together. I forget, are there talking animals in Princess Bride? No, there's not talking animals. There are rodents of unusual size.
Yes, there are. They don't talk. Yeah, that should definitely
play. Yeah, maybe is what. Maybe like Mr. Fox's mole friend or somebody like knows the rodents of unusual size. Maybe
somebody goes on vacation.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, yeah. So maybe Fantastic Mr. Fox comes first, and then in the second one, he and Mrs. Fox and maybe some of the others, go on vacation somewhere.
Right, right. And they go on vacation. So they're in the fantasy world of Princess Bride. They're not in. Because remember, there's a real world as well with Princess Bride.
Yes, yes.
So they're in the fantasy world. And what kind of adventures are they having besides encountering the rodents of unusual size?
Probably something that we see.
The children, like Buttercup. This is nice.
Okay.
Buttercup and Wesley are children.
Okay.
And to them, this is it. This is, yes, the fox talks. These other animals talk. And it's the delusion of childhood that they eventually think they are under, as opposed to, no, those are actually just, talking animals.
Right. All right, so the young versions of Buttercup and Wesley encounter the fox and some of the other animals. And then they must have to – see, in the first movie, Fox and the other animals were trying to outsmart some humans.
Right.
So that they could steal their food, basically.
So the second one,
somehow the kids –
maybe they're working with the kids to outsmart other humans.
Yeah.
The kids, Buttercup is very oppressed because she's a sheltered beauty.
Right.
Because she's so beautiful, they have to keep her away from everybody.
And she wants to bust out and cut loose and have some fun. And so she is eager to join in this caper, whatever it is.
Right.
And then probably Wesley comes along to save her or to keep an eye on her or protect her or something, maybe.
Right. There's somebody – we don't actually know it's Wesley.
Okay.
But somebody keeps getting them out of a jam that, seems impossible.
Right.
It seems like, well, this is it. Now they're finally cooked.
Right.
And they aren't because somebody's helping them. And it turns out it's Wesley, and then Wesley sticks around to be the farmhand to keep an eye on Buttercup.
Right. What sort of mission would it be? What are they trying to
do? The Six Finger Man. Six Finger Man is the evil one here.
Okay.
And what is he doing? He's got, he could just have a castle worth of stuff that they want.
Is he somehow going to take away Buttercup's family farm or something?
Maybe, yes. It's that, yeah, sure.
To do that, does he hold the mortgage on the Buttercup family farm?
That's what he does, all right.
Okay.
So it's a matter of, trying to, there's hijinks, of course.
Obviously, there'd be hijinks.
There's a lot of making fun of him for having six fingers, which he doesn't take kindly to.
Right. I'm trying to remember how many fingers the animals have in Fantastic Mr. Fox. I think they had the normal animal number of fingers.
Yeah, whatever that is.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, it's just as a farm saving thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. We probably also, not just the rodents of unusual size, but we introduced some of the other familiar Princess Bride characters.
Billy Crystal can get some
say,
work.
I think people would like to see him.
Because now he doesn't have to wear makeup now.
So that's Zing. Nice.
Miracle Max. Miracle Max, he's, oh! Maybe Buttercup just thinks that she's taken something from Miracle Max.
Oh, there you go. That's why she hears these animals talking.
That's how she's allowed to interact with them.
So the whole movie, she thinks she's tripping.
Yeah. this 10-year-old cautious little girl just thinks she's on drugs.
Far out. All right. Whatever, Fox. Let's go.
Let's go with it. Yeah.
All right. Buttercup's Strange Psychedelic Journey.
Is that the title?
Maybe.
Buttercup's
If it's a sequel to Fantastic Mr. Fox, it's going to be Mr. Fox's Great Adventure or something. Mr. Fox goes to town. Or something.
But it's not a town, exactly. But yeah, sure. Yeah. Whatever. I don't care about the title. I'm just happy to live in that world of both movies.
That'll be nice. Those are a couple of pleasant movies there. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. That's how you play Interquel.
Sure.
Or we toss that one out. Just a quick one. Just a quick one for you.
No big deal.
So to recap, we liked, what did we see? Oh, yeah, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Yeah, we liked it. That's good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
And I liked Zootopia a lot.
And then you guys know what we thought about London.
Right, because we reviewed that. Right. Totally at the same time that we recorded the rest of the show.
Yeah. No need to focus on it anymore.
Oh, yeah. For a question of the week, tell us what movie embarrasses you because of the way it depicts some part of your identity, be it your hometown, your religion, your physical traits.
Why are you looking at me when you say that?
Because you're a big, tall, gangly goob. And the way that big, tall, gangly goobs have been portrayed in movies, sometimes it's not very not very inclusive. And so that's all. So until next week, I'm Eric D. Snyder.
I'm Jeff Baer.
Thanks for listening and good day.
I said good day.